Chapter 30. Looking at his reflection in the mirror, Juan couldn't tell where his face ended and Kevin Nixon's makeup began. He glanced at the enlarged pictures that Kevin had taped to the mirror as a guide and then at his face again. It was a perfect match. The wig he wore was the exact shade, and the style was the same as well. "Kevin, you've outdone yourself," Juan said, and plucked away the paper collar Kevin had put around his throat to protect the tuxedo shirt he was sporting. "Making you look like Arab terrorist Ibn al-Asim is nothing. If you'd asked me to make you look like one of their floozies, then you can call me a miracle worker." Juan deftly tied his bow tie and shrugged his broad shoulders into a white dinner jacket. While nearly every man looks good in a tux, Cabrillo pulled it off with extra aplomb, even with the padding around his middle that filled out his physique to match Alassim's. It didn't hurt that their surveillance showed the terrorist financier favored Armani. He had a flat holster at the base of his spine for his preferred weapon, the FN 5.7 automatic pistol. "You look like James Bond with a paunch," Mike Trono said from across Kevin's cluttered workroom. In his best Sean Connery brogue, Juan shot back, "The janitorial staff is to be seen and not heard." Mike and Jerry Pulaski were wearing uniforms that matched the janitorial staff of the world-renowned Casino de Monte Carlo, having gotten the designs during a brief afternoon reconnoiter. Kevin and his staff kept hundreds of uniforms, everything from a Russian general to a New Delhi traffic cop to a Parisian zookeeper, so it took them only a few minutes to modify a standard jumpsuit to the style they wanted. Mike and Jerry carried a heavy-duty trash can on rollers, as well as a rolling mop bucket and a plastic sign warning slippery floor. The chief steward appeared at the doorway, silent and unobtrusive as always. He wore a crisp white apron over his suit. There was a debate among the crew as to whether he changed aprons before leaving the pantry or simply never spilled anything on himself. The odds favored the latter by a huge margin. He held a sealed plastic container in one hand like it was loaded with live snakes, and his face was cleaved by a deep frown. "For Pete's sake, Maurice," Juan teased, "it's not the real stuff." "Captain, I made it, so it is real enough. Let's take a look." Maurice set the container on Kevin's makeup counter and stepped back, steadfastly refusing to remove the lid. Juan pried it off and quickly turned his head.
"Whoa!
Did you have to make it so pungent?"
"You asked me to make you fake vomit. I treated this as I would any dish. So smell is as important as appearance and texture."
"Kinda smells like that fish thing you made for Yannicka," Mike quipped, resealing the lid and placing the container in his mop bucket. Maurice threw him the look of a school principal dressing down a rowdy pupil. "Mr. Trono, if you want anything other than bread and water for the foreseeable future, I would apologize."
"Hey, I liked that dish," Mike said, backpedaling as fast as he could.
No one on the Oregon took Maurice's threats lightly.
"So what's in it?"
"The base is pea soup, and the rest of the recipe is a trade secret."
Juan looked at him askance.
"You've done this before?"
"A prank in my youth against Charles Wright, the captain of a destroyer I was serving on. He made Bly look like Mother Teresa. The prig prided himself on his iron stomach, so during an inspection, we poured some of this concoction in his private head moments before a visiting admiral used it. The nickname Upchuck-Chuck dogged the remainder of his career."
They all laughed harder than the story warranted as a means of releasing tension. They always played their emotions close to the vest, especially just before an operation, so any chance to vent was seized on immediately.
"Will that be all, Captain?"
"Yes, Maurice, thanks."
"You're welcome."
He bowed out of the room, passing Dr. Huxley as she made her way to the magic shop. The men gave a chorus of catcalls and whistles. Hux wore a strapless dress in magenta silk that clung to her curves like a second skin.
Her hair had been teased from its regular ponytail into an elegant halo of curls and ringlets. Makeup accentuated her eyes and mouth and gave her skin a healthy glow. "Here you go," she said, and handed Cabrillo a slim leather case. He folded open the top to reveal 3 hypodermic needles in protective slots. "Inject this in a vein, and it's night-night in about 15 seconds. "The pills?" Juan asked. She pulled a standard plastic pill bottle from her matching clutch purse and shook the 2 capsules. "If Alasim has kidney problems, he's going to end up in the hospital before he needs to use the bathroom."
"How long before they take effect?"
10, maybe 15 minutes.
"You're sure he won't taste them?"
Hux rolled her eyes. They had already gone over this 3 times.
"Completely undetectable."
She also showed him she had her passport. Because native Monegasques aren't allowed into the casino, identification is verified at the entrance.
"Everybody have phones?" Juan asked.
Rather than draw attention to themselves with earbud radios and lapel microphones, they would use the walkie-talkie mode of their cell phones for communication. When everyone nodded, he said,
"All right then, let's get ashore and do this."
Designed by Charles Garnier, the architect of the fabled Paris Opera House, the Casino de Monte Carlo is nothing less than a cathedral dedicated to gambling. It was built in the sumptuous Napoleon III style that Garnier created, with beautiful fountains at its entrance, 2 distinctive towers, and an aged copper roof. The elegant atrium was lined with 28 onyx columns, and marble and stained glass abounded in every room. When Juan arrived, there were 3 Ferraris and a pair of Bentleys lined up under the porte cochere. The clientele streaming inside were the creme of society. The men were uniformly dressed in tuxedos, while the women looked like jewels in their gowns and dresses. He shot his cuff to check the time. Kerikov and Alasim never arrived before 10, so he was a half hour early. More than enough time to find an unobtrusive place to pass the time. It wouldn't do for Alasim to meet his doppelganger across the roulette wheel. His phone chirped.
"Chairman, Ski and I are in position," Mike Trono reported. "Any problems?"
"Dressed like janitors, we're practically invisible."
"Where are you now?"
"Just off the loading dock. We're keeping ourselves busy cleaning up a few jugs of cooking oil that Ski accidentally spilled on purpose."
"Okay. Hang tight and wait for my signal."
Cabrillo flashed his passport and paid his entrance fee. The crowds were all moving to the right, toward the elegant gaming rooms, so Juan followed the throng. He ambled his way upstairs to a bar, got himself a martini he had no intention of drinking, but thought appropriate considering his surroundings, and found a dark corner to wait. Hux called in moments later to announce she had also arrived and was in the Salon de l'Europe, the casino's principal gambling hall. While he waited, Juan put his mind to how he was going to rescue Max before they leveled Eos Island with the orbital ballistic projectile. There was no question in his mind that he would follow through with the island's destruction if they couldn't get Max. The stakes were too high, and even Max would agree. He wished there was a way to communicate back to Hanley using the ELF equipment, but it was a transmitter, not a receiver. Juan went through a dozen ideas, worked them in his mind, and ultimately rejected every one as being ill-conceived.
"They're here," Julius said over the phone after he'd been at the bar for 20 minutes. "They're heading for a Chemin de Fer table. Let them get settled and have a few drinks first."
Down in the casino, Julia Huxley divided her attention between the roulette wheel and their target. Her pile of chips ebbed and flowed as time wore on, while across the room, Ibn Alasim was on his 3rd drink. She thought it ironic that he was willing to finance arms for fundamentalist Muslim terror groups and yet flout one of the best-known Muslim laws by drinking alcohol. She suspected he thought of himself as a takfir, a true believer in Islam who ignored its tenets in order to infiltrate Western society. Of course, he accomplished this merely by eschewing traditional robes and not sporting a heavy beard. The drinking and the womanizing weren't necessary. They were simply activities he obviously enjoyed. "I think it's time, Juan," she said into her phone, pretending to check a text message.
"Okay, do it.
Mike, get ready for Operation V." Julia waited until the roulette ball dropped into the number 6 slot and the dealer raked the losing chips, hers included, from the table, before tossing him a tip and collecting her remaining stack. She pulled the 2 pills from her purse and started across the room. A few men eyed her as she passed, but most everybody was concentrating on his or her game. There were no empty seats at the table where Kirikov and Alasim were playing, so Julia hung back, waiting for her opportunity. When the Russian won a particularly large hand, Julia leaned close to him and whispered, "Congratulations," in his ear. He was startled at first, then smiled when he saw how Hux looked. She did it again when another player hit it big, and suddenly, her presence here wasn't that of a stranger, but part of the gaming circle. She then placed a small wager on top of this second player's stack, so that if he won, so would she. When he didn't win, he apologized, but Julia only shrugged, as if to say it was no big deal. She then gestured to Alasim, wordlessly asking permission to place chips with him. He nodded, and when she reached across the table, she set her hand next to his drink to balance herself. When she straightened, she almost knocked the glass over. She grabbed it just before it spilled, dropped the 2 pills in it, and set it back on its coaster. The pills were a homeopathic compound that addicts on probation use to flush their bodies of drugs prior to testing, as a way of avoiding more jail time. Julia had studied the compounds and found they didn't really work, but they had a side effect of making a person need to urinate. Doping Alasim with it was their way of getting him to the casino's restroom on their schedule rather than on his. Alasim didn't suspect a thing. He played his hand and won, grinning wolfishly when he handed Julia her winnings. "Merci, monsieur," she said. She played one more time with a different player, lost, and drifted away from the table. When she stepped out of the gambling hall and back into the towering atrium, she called Cabrillo to tell him it was done. "Okay, find a place to watch him, and let us know when he's headed for the bathroom, and then get yourself back to the marina," Juan ordered as he headed down to the lavatory closest to the Salon de l'Europe. "Mike, you and Ski move into position."
"On our way."
There was a doorway a short distance from the restroom that led to the building's service corridors, so the guests didn't need to be bothered with seeing things like the janitors or the waitstaff who fetched patrons' drinks. Juan loitered next to the door for just a moment before it opened slightly and Mike handed him the bottle of fake vomit. Juan let a few more minutes trickle by to give the drug time to work before entering the restroom. Like everything else about the casino, the restroom was all marble and gilt. There was a man washing his hands when Cabrillo entered, but he left before Juan could even reach the stalls. With no one to hear his performance, he didn't have to act out being ill. He just poured the noisome concoction on the floor and retreated to a stall. It took only one patron entering the bathroom for a casino employee to be summoned. Juan didn't understand much French, but the attendant's assuring tone meant that the janitorial staff would be notified immediately. He could picture the attendant making for the nearest service entrance to notify housekeeping, only to discover 2 janitors in the hallway already, as if they had been told of the mess. The bathroom door opened again, and Juan heard the big trash barrel's wheels squeaking as they pushed it in. "Howdy, boys," he said, and stepped from the stall. "Why do we always get the glamour jobs?" Mike asked with heavy sarcasm.
"Because you know how to make a floor shine."
The door opened again. Ski was there to shoo the patron away with an apologetic nod toward the filth being mopped from the floor.
"He just got up from the table," Julia informed Cabrillo. "He's going to be the next guy coming into the bathroom."
"Roger that. See you later,"
Juan retreated back into the stall. When the door opened, Ski let Alasim enter the restroom. The Arab made a face at the smell, but his need was greater than his revulsion, and he practically sprinted to a urinal. Cabrillo waited for him to finish before stepping silently behind him. Alasim felt his presence at the last moment and turned. His eyes widened at seeing his identical twin, but before he could understand what was happening, Juan jammed the hypodermic needle into his neck and depressed the plunger. Alasim made to cry out, so Juan clamped a hand over his mouth and held him until he slipped into unconsciousness. Ski had to refuse entry to another patron as Juan and Trono dumped the terrorist financier into the large trash can. Juan replaced his own watch with the slim Movado Alasim wore and slipped Alasim's large ring on a finger. "I should be finished with Kirikov before he comes to," Juan said, checking himself in the mirror. "Just leave him where he won't be found for a few hours and get yourselves back to the Oregon with Julia." "There's a utility closet near the loading dock. At this hour, no one will be using it." Mike finished restoring the floor to its glossy shine and tossed the mop in the bucket. "See you boys later." Juan made his way back to the chemin de fer table where Kirikov was dealing from the shoe. "Are you all right, my friend?" the Russian asked in English, the only language he shared with the Arab. "A little stomach trouble, Ivan. Nothing to worry about." Cabrillo had listened to several hours of taped conversation between the two men and knew how they spoke to one another. The arms dealer hadn't given his appearance a second glance. The disguise worked perfectly. They played for another 45 minutes, Juan acting as though his condition was worsening, and it showed on how he played. He bet foolishly and cut Alasim's $50,000 worth of chips in half. "Ivan, I'm sorry," he said, holding a hand across his stomach. "I think I need to return to the boat."
"Do you need a doctor?"
"I don't think it's that serious. I just need to lie down." Juan declined the shoe when it was his turn to deal and got unsteadily to his feet. "You keep playing, please."
It was a risk to make the offer, but it was something Alasim definitely would have done. Kirikov seemed to give it thought. He was up about $30,000 since they'd started gambling, and he hated to walk away from a winning streak. On the other hand, the way things were going with Alasim, he might become one of his best clients.
"I have taken enough of their money for one night."
He pushed the six-deck shoe to the Asian man to his left. When he stood, his jacket bunched across his heavy shoulders. They handed in their chips and left the money on account with the casino for when they returned the next evening. As they walked through the ornate atrium, Kirikov called his driver on his cell phone so the limousine would be around front when they exited the building. The driver pulled up to the entrance but remained behind the wheel. It was Kirikov's bodyguard who jumped from the front seat and opened the rear door. He was a good 4 inches taller than Cabrillo, with dark, distrusting eyes. He scanned the crowd as Kirikov maneuvered himself into the car and pegged Juan with a hard stare. Instinct would have been to look away, and if Cabrillo had, the guard would have known something was amiss. But Juan had spent a lifetime training to ignore instinct. Instead of lowering his eyes, he stared back just as fiercely and asked, "Is there something wrong?" The bodyguard softened his expression.
"Yet."
Juan got into the car and the door was closed behind him. It was a short drive to the marina. Juan played up his intestinal discomfort so he wouldn't need to talk with the Russian as the limo wound its way down to the waterfront. Kirikov had a private launch from his yacht, Matryoshka, waiting for them at the marina. The guard sprang out of the car as soon as it stopped to open the back door.
"Good thing we didn't waste money on any ladies this evening," Kirikov remarked as they walked to where the gleaming white launch was tied. "I don't feel well enough even to look at a woman right now. In fact, I'm not really eager for this ride out to your boat."
Kirikov placed a beefy hand on Cabrillo's shoulder.
"It's only a short hop, and the harbor is as smooth as glass. You'll do fine."
The bodyguard fired up the launch's engine while the limo driver helped with the bow and stern lines. 5 minutes later, they approached the broad transom of the Matryoshka, where a teak dive platform had been lowered and a flight of stairs gave access to the monster boat's main deck.
"I should think you are going straight to your cabin," Kirikov remarked as they stepped aboard.
A servant was waiting at the top of the steps, should the Russian require anything, and Juan saw two guards, one up on the sun deck behind the bridge and the other patrolling near the ship's pool. His team had estimated there were at least 18 crewmen to run the mega yacht and a 10-man security detail.
"Actually," Juan replied, "I would like to talk to you in your office."
"Nothing too sensitive," Kirikov inquired at once.
He knew how easily someone could eavesdrop on his ship so close to shore.
"No, no, no," Juan said at once. "Just something that occurred to me tonight."
Kirikov led them through the luxurious vessel, passing by a dining room that could seat 20 and a movie theater with double that capacity. The former hardline communist spy had certainly availed himself of the trappings of capitalism. They reached the Russian's private office, and as soon as Kirikov closed the door behind them, Juan had his pistol out and pressed to Kirikov's throat hard enough to tear skin.
"One sound and you're dead."
Juan had dropped his phony Arabic accent and spoke in Russian. To his credit, Kirikov didn't move. He had probably been on the giving end of this situation enough to know that if his attacker's motive was assassination, he would already be dead.
"Who are you?"
Juan said nothing while he fitted Kirikov's wrists with a pair of flexi-cuffs.
"Even though you speak my language, you are CIA, I think, and not FSB. I must congratulate you. When I did my research on Ibn al-Asim, his background was unimpeachable. You went a very long way in establishing his bona fides. A great many trusted people assured me he was legitimate."
"I'm not Ibn al-Asim," Juan said.
Kirikov smirked.
"Obviously not.
He's back at the casino in a trash can near the loading dock. He should regain consciousness in another couple hours."
Kirikov's eyes narrowed as he tried to get his mind around the situation. Juan let him dangle a moment longer.
"As far as I know, you and al-Asim are old college roommates in Monte Carlo having a few laughs together. I don't care what you two are scheming. I'm here about something you stole from your former employers."
"I stole a great deal from them," Kirikov said with unabashed pride.
Juan had done enough research on the Russian arms dealer to want to put a bullet through his brain and rid the world of one less dirtbag. It took effort not to pull the trigger.
"I want the codes for Stalin's fist."
The fact that he had mentioned the weapon only a short while ago to al-Asim wasn't lost on Kirikov. He again asked who Juan was.
"You're an assassin if you don't give me what I want."
"You've had me under surveillance, haven't you?"
"My organization has been watching you for some time," Juan told him, which wasn't exactly a lie. "We are only interested in the codes for the orbital ballistic projectile satellite. Give me what I want and you and al-Asim can continue your arms deal without interference. Otherwise, you die tonight."
When Juan had cleared this operation through Langston Overholt, the CIA man had insisted that it in no way jeopardized their long-term plan to turn al-Asim. Cabrillo cocked his pistol to punctuate the statement. Kirikov tried to stare him down and didn't blink when he saw Juan's finger beginning to squeeze the trigger.
"Pull that trigger and my security team will be in here in 20 seconds," he warned.
"My soul is prepared for martyrdom," Juan retorted,
clouding his role by making it sound he was on a religious quest.
"Is yours?"
Kirikov blew out a heavy sigh.
"God, I miss the Cold War."
"You're Chechen, aren't you?" "If it appeases whatever remains of your conscience, I am not Chechen, and the weapon won't be used anywhere within the former Soviet Union.
He could almost see Kurikov thinking that the weapon wouldn't be used at all.
The codes are locked in the safe behind that painting.
He nodded toward a nude hanging on one wall. Juan used the barrel of his pistol to swing the painting back on its long hinge in case it was booby-trapped. The safe was about 2 feet square with a 10-digit electronic pad.
Combination?
25101917.
It took Juan a second to recognize the numbers, because Europeans put days ahead of months when giving dates.
The date of Russia's October Revolution. Nice touch.
He punched in the numbers and made Kurikov stand directly in front of the safe when he threw the handle. Juan had recognized the safe model and knew if an incorrect code had been entered, a stun grenade would detonate. The code was legitimate. Inside were stacks of currency, a pistol, which Juan stuffed in his pocket, and countless folders and files.
Should be near the bottom, Kurikov offered, to get this ordeal over with quicker.
Juan scanned some of the documents as he searched. The Russian was involved in some heavy deals, including arming Saddam Hussein before the U.S. invasion, and a triangle trade of Afghan opium for Russian weapons for African conflict diamonds. Near the bottom was a file with the label November Sky in Cyrillic. Juan leafed through a couple of pages, satisfying himself that it was what he was after. Once the computer aboard the Oregon translated it into English, he assumed Eric and Holly could understand the technical jargon. He slid the document into a waterproof bag and turned to Kurikov. As much as he wanted to tell Kurikov what he thought of him, Juan held his tongue.
When you find Alasim, tell him what happened tonight is unrelated to your business together. Tell him it is a piece of your past coming back to haunt you, but the situation is now resolved. Now, please turn around and drop to your knees.
For the first time since Juan had pulled the gun on him, Kurikov showed fear. It was in his eyes, though he managed to keep it out of his voice.
You got what you wanted. I am not going to kill you.
Juan withdrew the hypodermic case and removed one of the needles.
It's the same drug I gave Alasim. You'll be out for a few hours. Nothing more. I hate needles. I'd rather have you hit me over the head.
Juan smashed his FN into Kurikov's temple so hard that a pound or two of extra force would have shattered the bone and killed him. He collapsed like an imploded building.
Suit yourself, Juan said,
and jabbed the needle home anyway. The outside wall of Kurikov's office was curved glass that bowed out from the hull in a shallow arc. Juan opened one of the windows and peered upward. There was no one hanging over the railing above him. He stripped out of his tux jacket, shirt, and the fat suit. Beneath it, he wore a skin-tight black T-shirt with long sleeves. After stuffing the waterproof bag under the shirt and tossing Kurikov's pistol out the window, he kicked off his shoes and eased himself into the water. So long as he remained silent and didn't look up so his face wouldn't show, his black wig made him blend in with the inky Mediterranean. He swam forward along the Matryoshka's hull until he came to the anchor chain. There, he dove under the surface, crawling link by link down the chain until he came to the diving equipment Eddie and Franklin had cached earlier. He donned the Draeger rebreather, weight belt, fins, and mask, and took a bearing off the luminous compass they had left for him. The Oregon was only a mile away, and with the slack tide, his going would be even easier. As he swam, he made a silent vow that this wouldn't be the last time he paid a visit to Ivan Kurikov, and that the Russian wouldn't fare so well in their next meeting.